The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Thanks for joining us here on Mix 92.6. You're listening to The Parents Show. Joining us this evening is Michelle Bolton from DS Achieve. Michelle, welcome to The Parents Show. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your role is at DS Achieve?
Hi, Neil. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. So as you said, I'm Michelle Bolton. I'm the head of operations at a charity called DS Achieve. DS Achieve was set up by a small group of parents of children with Down syndrome in 2018, and I was one of those parents. So we basically offer services to the Down syndrome community. We work very closely with families, professionals, and all types of professionals, so education, therapy, medical, to enable children and young people with Down syndrome to achieve their potential, whatever that looks like. And for every individual, that can be very different.
Great, thank you. So in that case, what is it you're trying to, well, pardon the pun, what is it you're trying to achieve? What, in practical ways, how do you get involved with those families and those kids?
So we felt, as when we set up as a group of parents, as parents ourselves of children with Down syndrome, we were thinking to ourselves, you know, what do we actively need? What do our families need? What do our children need? What do we need as parents? And, you know, the local authorities, you know, resource limited, budget limited, and lots of fantastic charities out there, but we felt there was a real gap. So our aim is to reach those families and work with professionals by focusing on education and training. So we offer a number of services working with families and professionals to either enable parents to better support their children and enable their progression, or professionals to support the families they work with to enable children to progress. So we focus on education directly to children and young people with Down syndrome. We have two programs, which one is our Little Achievers, so they are 0 to 5-year-olds, and the other is our Young Achievers, so that's social skills for school-age children, working directly with those children and young people with Down syndrome to progress their skills. We also offer a number of other services around training, so directly with professionals and parents. We offer bespoke training where we go into schools and work directly with teaching teams, and that's more bespoke to the individual child with Down syndrome. So what are their challenges? What are their needs? And how can we help the people working with them to enable that child to get the most out of their education and access the most of the curriculum? We do a lot of work with young children with Down syndrome outside of our groups. So we offer something called Resources Into Homes, where we work with parents and help them to use specialist resources for children with Down syndrome. So children with Down syndrome, or people with Down syndrome, have a very specific learning profile, very visual learners. Every individual, very different, but the learning profile tends to be the same. And so we can really harness that to help get in there early intervention, practice and focus on some of those skills to get children ready for school, to help them in school, to get ready for secondary school, and so on. So something for parents, as I said, resources into homes at that very early stage. Parents are children's first teacher. And so helping them to feel they've got the information, awareness, support, resources to do the best job that they can, which is, of course, what every parent wants to do for their child, is really important to us. And then we also offer a very similar service where we go into schools, as I mentioned before, and that's Resources Into Schools. For parents who have a child with SEND, so Special Educational Needs and Disability, no doubt they will have heard of the EHCP, the Education Health and Care Plan, and that can be a real kind of jungle for parents to navigate through, lots of legal jargon, process heavy. So we also offer something to parents to support them with that, with a qualified, experienced legal professional, the solicitor that we work with. So it's kind of a real range. And for us, the really important thing is that we are supporting and enabling families and professionals to do what they want to do as best as they can.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you're kind of all and any assistance families working with this might need, you guys are covering it. So what I was interested in as well is, I'd imagine this is a world you kind of found yourself in. And I imagine, you know, without wanting to second guess your own experience, which we will come to, I imagine this was born out of you looking around for support and what was available because of your own situation. So what kind of support is available to families of kids with Down syndrome?
It really varies. And unfortunately, and I think lots of listeners, if they have a child with Down syndrome, would agree, it's unfortunately a bit of a postcode lottery. Depending on the area you live in, you might have access to particular therapy services or specialist services. Sometimes those are more forthcoming than, you know, for others. So yeah, as you said, you know, I found myself in a situation where all of a sudden I'm a parent of a child with Down syndrome, and it really opened my eyes to this whole new world. So immediately, you know, there was a community pediatrician involved. Not every parent knows that they're entitled to see a community pediatrician. Waiting lists are long. They kind of coordinate the care that your child would receive from other departments. So we have occupational therapy, physiotherapy, speech and language therapy. Speech and language for younger children is also looking at feeding as well as actual speech and communication. And then children and young people with Down syndrome, or people with Down syndrome more generally, are more likely to have particular medical conditions. So 50% of babies born with Down syndrome have a heart defect. I was very, I guess, fortunate in terms of the distress that must cause when your baby is seriously ill, in that my son with Down syndrome didn't have a heart defect when he was born. But there are other medical conditions as well as with the heart. So my son have respiratory issues. It's more likely to have things like glue ear. So audiology gets involved. Every person with Down syndrome has vision issues. There's something called visual acuity, which means no matter how good your glasses, your vision's always going to be a little bit blurry. So yeah, you kind of need a full range of professionals involved. And that's part of the work we're doing at DS Achieve, is making parents aware that there are these services out there. You are entitled to, you know, access them and be assessed by them and see what your child needs. And unfortunately, it is a bit of a fight, but that's why we're here, to help parents do, you know, make that battle, I guess.
That's fantastic. I can imagine so many parents are so relieved that you guys exist. If it's not too personal, Michelle, I'd love to ask, what was your own experience of having a child with Down syndrome? You know, what was that like? Because I guess people have a kind of Instagram idea of how pregnancy works and how fertility works. So if it's not too personal, if you're comfortable with it, I'd love to hear your story of how it all unfolded.
Yeah, of course. No, I'm incredibly proud to talk about all three of my children. So yeah, mum of three. I have a daughter, Charlotte, who's nearly 12. And then my second child, my middle child, is Tom, who has Down syndrome. And then I have a younger son, Max, who's 7. Tom's going to be 10 next month. So it takes me back a little bit talking about coming into the world and to the community of Down syndrome. So we had a very easy, healthy pregnancy. I felt really well, not unlike when I was pregnant with my daughter, my older daughter. And when Tom was born, there was something called a single palmar crease on one of the palms of his hands. And that is one of the markers for Down syndrome. And it was through that that we ended up having, yeah, Tom had a blood test and the diagnosis was confirmed. But it's, I think in terms of the story, it's really important to highlight that, and I hope this isn't sort of too emotional for anyone kind of going through it, but if you know nothing about Down syndrome, and I certainly didn't, I didn't know anything about the condition, I'd never met anyone with Down syndrome, it's the only thing that's tested for when you're pregnant. And so you kind of get the impression, when you know nothing else, that it must be the worst thing in the world. It's the only thing. Yeah, it must be horrific and terrifying. And so I'm kind of really glad that I didn't know when I was pregnant with Tom that he had Down syndrome, because I think I would have been quite terrified knowing that it's the only thing that's tested for. So when he was born and I found out, I'll admit I was still really quite distressed, because again, I knew nothing. There's so many unknowns. The way that it's phrased when you get that diagnosis, to me, it was phrased like, "I'm so sorry, Mrs. Bolton. Are you sitting? Oh, I'm afraid I've got some devastating news."
Wow.
And it was positioned in a way that kind of said to me that my life was over and that I was given a life sentence. Yeah. And when you're in that kind of really emotional, vulnerable state, that really impacts you. And your mindset kind of gets based on how that message is delivered. There's a lot of work going on out there right now to work with medical professionals, many of whom are absolutely fantastic and are getting this stuff really right. Unfortunately for me, that wasn't the case. But so once I knew that Tom had Down syndrome, there was a period of adjustment for myself and my husband. We wanted to find out as much as we could, as quickly as possible. And I was scooped up by a friend of a friend who I'd never met before, who was a parent or is a parent of a child with Down syndrome. Her name's Juliet, and she's a very proud mum of Emily, who, I think she's 16 now, which, is getting so big. And I met their family, and I saw that life is just regular. It's quite typical. Yes, there are lots of extra challenges, but I always say to everyone, if only I knew then what I know now, my mindset from the beginning would have been one of excitement and just, pure happiness and belief in, the happiness we would have in the future. And at the time, all of that was challenged and the future looked so unknown. Tom has been, and people throw this term around, but a blessing in so many ways, because, I used to live a very corporate focused life. I was all about my career, working, so hard in London. And he's really changed my perspective on everything. And here I am now running a charity, trying to help other families to have the same kind of experiences that we are and support them to find out more. And he's just a joyous, wonderful little boy. I've heard things like, oh, people with Down syndrome, they're always happy. Let me tell you that that's not the case. He has the full range of emotion. Just this morning, I was met with a very sassy phrase. He said to me, well, let me be the judge of that, when I was trying to get him to do something to get ready for school. So it's very different than I think it's positioned by medical professionals at those very early stages, when they themselves, unfortunately, don't know any better. And for us, my husband and I, it's very much about finding out what we could and meeting other families and seeing what life looks like. And we were incredibly reassured by that. And it's not to say there aren't challenges. Tom has a few health issues. We see, lots of different professionals. But the main challenge I find is nothing to do with Tom as an individual. The challenge, unfortunately, is the system. It's about the access to the services. It's about the lack of resource and budget. It's about getting the support he needs to access the curriculum in his mainstream school. So, lots of brilliant things. And I wish I'd known them what I know now.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sharing that. That's fantastic. So it's almost gone full circle. And now you feel really lucky that you got a special one.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, lots of people, talk about his special children and special families. And he's just a regular child and we're just a regular family. And people say to me, or they used to when we had all the appointments, oh, I don't know how you do it. Like, he's my child. And you would do exactly the same. You love your children. You would do anything for them. And just like my other two children, I would do anything for him.
So that's interesting. You've touched on a lot of the challenges, and which I can imagine around having a child with Down syndrome, but with the absolute understanding that they're all completely different. But, what are some of the unexpected joys of it, if that's not a daft question?
Yeah, no, it's not a daft question at all. I think he's just, Tom has changed my perspective on life. He really has. I was always so kind of focused on, progression at work. And, I worked in a very corporate environment. I was the kind of parent that, dare I say, it might have been a bit competitive with how my children did at school and that sort of thing. I dread to even say those words now. It's really just changed my mindset. And for me, life now and life, in my opinion, should be about being happy and doing things that bring you joy. And it's as long as you are doing your best and you are achieving the most that you can achieve and you work hard, that's all you can ask of anyone. My daughter's recently started secondary school. She's coming to the end of year 7. And she's the type of child, as is my youngest child, who will go and sit with the person that is sitting on their own, who will look out for someone they can see is struggling. They're mature in a way that I could never have taught. It's the benefit of having a brother with Down syndrome who they both adore and he adores them. So it's changed us in ways you could never plan or script or, even sort of imagine, I guess. It just naturally happens and it's the best thing.
That's so lovely. And it's like, it's the polar opposite of a doctor sitting you down and saying, I'm sorry, I've got some grim news. It almost sounds like it's made your family even more amazing than you could have hoped,
Well, I kind of think sometimes I quite like to go back and see that doctor who delivered that news. And in fact, based on this morning, Tom might walk in and say, excuse me, I'll be the judge of that.
So look, Michelle, I'm sure this is been really interesting and hopefully quite useful for some parents listening, particularly any parents out there who do have young children of their own with Down syndrome. How can people find out more about DS Achieve and what you're trying to do?
That's a really great question. The thing for us is we want to reach as many families as possible and the professionals that those families are working with. It's all about supporting the families and professionals to enable that child or young person to achieve their potential. So the best ways to find out more about us, get in touch. We have our website, which is dsachieve.org. We are on Facebook, DS Achieve. And if you can get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. And we want to do everything we can to support you in your journey and help you face the challenges and help you understand, you know, what you can do to make, you know, things easier. I think I've been very lucky as a parent. I have English as my first language. I'm surrounded by a fantastically well-informed group of other parents. I don't have any other kind of things going on myself in terms of a disability. And I think there are parents out there who may be struggling, who don't have English as a first language, who hear the words EHCP and just shudder and kind of hide their head in the sand. And we really want to reach those people and say, let us help you. Let us help you navigate through it, get the information you need, because it's all directed to their child getting what they deserve, what they're entitled to, and hopefully therefore achieving their potential.
And I know that I've seen your website. People can just Google DS Achieve Hertfordshire and that comes straight up there. So you'll find that. One thing I wanted to ask, Michelle, is for people who haven't really interacted too much with people with Down syndrome or met many people, you know, what advice would you give the rest of us?
Gosh, another great question. I'd say every individual with Down syndrome is different. I'd say be confident, be kind, be warm. Tom, my son, can instantly tell if someone's just kind of doing what they should do rather than really wanting to speak to him. He does have a learning disability. Everyone with Down syndrome does have a learning disability. So if you ask him a question and he doesn't respond instantly, give him a few more seconds. And if you need to, repeat the question. He doesn't always want to engage. And that can be for a whole myriad of reasons, you know, tiredness. He's got a lot going on in terms of, yeah, senses. Maybe he's a bit overwhelmed. So don't ever take it personally. Give a little bit more time to answer and just be friendly. Say hi, ask questions. We really want to help raise awareness and educate the wider population who don't know anyone with Down syndrome, because there's nothing scary and there's everything wonderful.
Oh, what a great note to end on. Michelle, it sounds like the work you're doing is absolutely fantastic. Your family sounds incredible. Thank you so much for joining us on The Parent Show, and thank you for being so open and honest with us and teaching us such a good lesson. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Neil. Much appreciated.
Good evening and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury. And tonight I'm really delighted to be joined by Jodie Moore, who's a family lawyer at Raiden Solicitors. And Jodie's going to talk to us tonight and on the show about parental alienation. So if you don't know what that is, please stay tuned. And even if you do know what it is, stay tuned to listen to Jodie talking to us about this topic. So, Jodie, thanks a million for joining us on The Parents Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on The Parents Show, Lydia. It's really lovely to be here and I'm excited to have our chat today.
Brilliant. It's our pleasure. Now, I want to start off. We know you're a family lawyer at Raiden Solicitors. Tell us a little bit more about your role.
Yeah, so I'm an associate solicitor at the team at Raiden's in St Albans. I work exclusively in the area of family law and assist families with issues relating to the breakdown of their relationships. So on a day-to-day basis, that's normally involves dealing with arrangements for children, as well as helping people with financial claims on divorce and separation from a, you know, a wide range of financial circumstances. I personally have a particular interest in advising parents about issues relating to their children, which can include circumstances where parental alienation is present.
So now I have to admit that when I heard that you and I were going to chat about parental alienation, I didn't have a clue what parental alienation is. So can I ask you to tell our listeners what exactly it is in case they, like me, don't know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, parental alienation is something that has been around for a long time as a concept, but has really only started to gain traction in England over the last 20 years or so. And, you know, it's building as a concept. So it's not surprising necessarily that you haven't heard of it per se. And it essentially involves one parent either deliberately or even inadvertently alienating a child from the other parent. So it's an ongoing pattern of negative attitudes and behaviours of one parent. And it has the potential, or sometimes the expressed intention, to undermine or obstruct the child's relationship with the other parent.
Yeah, nice and simple. So it basically is when one parent, as it consciously or unconsciously, is, I suppose, trying to keep the child close to them and to the detriment of their relationship with the other parent.
Yeah, exactly. What I would say, though, is often the term parental alienation is used, and that sometimes there are, you know, genuine behaviours that are there. But also on the flip side, if you've come out of a, you know, potentially really abusive relationship, quite often the counter argument to somebody alleging domestic abuse is to say, well, no, hang on a minute. You know, the child doesn't want to spend time with me because you're alienating them against me, as opposed to, you know, there are these other safeguarding issues. So it's a really, really tricky area. And there are lots of different, you know, competing factors at play. But parental alienation, you know, when it rightfully exists, is about those behaviours which have the impact of obstructing that relationship and, you know, ultimately potentially leading to the child not having a relationship at all with one of their parents.
And I would imagine it's extremely common. I think there's probably a little bit of human nature involved in there. But can you give us examples of how it manifests itself so our parents can get a clear idea of what it looks like?
Absolutely. So it's a spectrum. So I think, you know, when people separate, sometimes it exists in a mild form and sometimes, you know, it becomes very extreme. But it's essentially, you know, the perpetuation of negative attitudes and beliefs that really seek to demean or ridicule or dismiss the other parent. You know, it can even go as far as conveying beliefs or, you know, false beliefs or stories so that, you know, the child misremembers information or thinks that something's happened, you know, like potentially, you know, daddy hit me, when that's, you know, completely false narrative. And ultimately, this can lead to a child falsely believing that the parent who's subject to alienating behaviours is dangerous or unworthy. And fundamentally, it's, you know, it's emotional abuse of the child at its most extreme level.
I think that'll probably be a bit of an eye-opener to parents. It certainly is to me, to think that at its extreme, it's actually a form of emotional manipulation or abuse. So it has to be taken really seriously, Jodie.
Absolutely. You know, it really does. And I think obviously at a breakdown of a relationship, you know, there's a lot of hurt there, which is completely understandable, but it's, you know, keeping in check how you're presenting and how you're parenting so that your child isn't involved in that conflict and doesn't take on, is unnecessarily involved if they don't have to. Although I appreciate, you know, that can be really difficult when you're hurting, and a lot, you know, that's why I say it can sometimes even be inadvertent. It's not an intentional thing that somebody's doing. It's just, you know, as a result of the relationship or as a result of them, they don't realize that they're having this impact on their child.
Yeah, absolutely. And so is there anything that can be done about it? You know, I've seen friends and family go through divorce, and actually the behaviour describing, I've seen occasionally too, I'm sure everybody else has. But can anything be done about it?
Yeah, I think it's important to take early action. And, you know, obviously that behaviour is on a spectrum. So what that action looks like depends on the extent of the behaviours in question, because it can often start off slowly and then over a number of years it can sort of build up. So quite often by the time somebody comes to see someone like me, there's already been significant damage to that relationship. And sometimes that's, you know, almost completely broken down, or the parent and child haven't spent time together for a period of time. So, you know, it's really important to seek advice early to see what can be done. In terms of how to approach solving it, you know, it really is about acting quickly, delay can be very damaging to those relationships. If contact is at the point where it's starting to break down or is already broken down, it's important to, you know, name it, see it, and notice the existence of these factors and try and get contact up and running again. You know, this might involve issuing a court application so that there's a contact order in place. You know, if things haven't quite got to that stage yet, it may be that you want to consider mediation. And certainly I sometimes suggest to clients that they go to family inclusive mediation. And that's where the children would have a voice within that setting. So rather than the parents just deciding what happens, they're involved in that process too. But I think it's, the key thing is not to let matters drift and take action to prevent it from happening where possible.
When you say take action, who should take action?
The parent that believes that the child is being alienated against them to ensure that that relationship isn't damaged. Because, you know, it's really, really important. There's a lot of research about how, and I caveat this to say, you know, where it's safe to do so, children should be having good, positive relationships with both parents. And if they don't, that can be, you know, incredibly damaging for them moving forward.
Brilliant. That's so, so nice and clear. So nip it in the bud, get in early. If you're noticing as a parent that you're being alienated from your child or your relationship is deteriorating. And so you suggested mediation as a solution to this. So if, for example, two parents are struggling to communicate, and this sounds like the relationship with the child would be a byproduct of the deterioration of the relationship, they should nonetheless reach out, do the best they can, and mediation would be a route to solve that.
Yeah, I think so in the first instance. But what I would say is, if it's not working, you know, don't continue down the route of mediation, because it may be, you know, it may be that hopefully a conversation between the two of you, a discussion, particularly if it's being done inadvertently, can really, you know, bring the parents together and they can, you know, find a really positive way forward. But in really serious cases where, you know, this is very deliberate and is a pattern of manipulation, really the best thing to be doing is to be making that application to court so that you have that structure and you have the court orders in place to say that that relationship should be maintained. So mediation absolutely has its place and can be really, really helpful, but isn't something that you should, you know, if it's not working, it's not working. And because of the seriousness of parental alienation and the consequences on the relationship and on the child, it's important to take action quickly, potentially through the courts. And the courts then have, you know, a lot of different powers as part of the scope of their investigation and how they're helping the family to try and resolve these issues as well. And that could be anything from, you know, ordering that the parents and or the child go through therapeutic support. It, you know, really extreme cases, the court can even say, you know, hang on a minute, the child should live and spend a period of time living with the parent who has been alienated against to try and, you know, rebuild that relationship in an accelerated way, even if they were primarily living or exclusively living with the other parent. But obviously that's, you know, the most extreme sort of circumstances.
That's great to know that the court has the power to ultimately step in and protect the child. Is would that be a right way of describing what the court can do?
Yeah, so I mean, the court would be looking to explore whether these alienating behaviours exist, and if so, what action can be taken, and that would involve ordering things such as therapeutic support. If the court are at such a stage where they, you know, are genuinely really, really concerned about the welfare of the child as a result of this, they can even suggest that the local authority become involved. So that's something that is available to them, you know, and I'm talking about the most extreme cases for that sort of thing. But, you know, it's a power that the court have to say, look, we're really concerned. We think the local authority should be involved. And the local authority can then, you know, potentially work with the family as well.
So there are definitely measures available to parents to do something about this, the court, local authorities. Are there any other avenues that can be explored to protect the child as early as possible?
I think it's really about identifying that behaviour and seeing it and calling it, because if it's there, then, you know, you can then look at trying to move things forward. And, you know, even as far as saying, for example, you know, the relationship has broken down, you were every Saturday before that, you were taking the children swimming, all of a sudden that's not happening. It's to sort of say, look, you know, keep it child focused. Look, we've separated. you know, I really want to still be able to do that. We used to love doing that together. You know, can we keep doing that together? And looking at problems like that and just really trying to bring it back to the child and what's in their best interests.
That's lovely and simple. Thanks, Jodie, because it's always great to hear the words that you could use in that scenario just to kind of break the ice, break the deadlock, I guess. So that's really, really helpful. Now, from your perspective, does it matter if the person who's been alienated is your client or the other parent?
No, I mean, we act on both sides and, you know, we come to it and looking at what our client is saying and what's happening. And as I touched on earlier, whilst parental alienation often exists and it, you know, it's very sad when it is going on the flip side of it, you know, there are often cases in which somebody says, look, I've been accused of parental alienation. This is absolutely not what's going on. This is just a further attempt to control me and to continue abuse that was going on within the relationship. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether the allegations are against you or you are the one saying that you are being alienated. It's important to take advice and we can help with both sets of circumstances.
And I can imagine with, you know, with vast experience within your law firm, you'll probably have seen patterns of behavior and be able to kind of know what's going on quicker because you'll have had a lot of experience of previous techniques of alienation or manipulation that you've seen in parents.
Absolutely. And I would say as well, you know, if you are concerned that this is something that's going on, it's really important to just keep a record of it. You know, keep a record of when, you know, contact was set up and it didn't happen for whatever reason, because it really helps to build a picture. And, you know, sometimes alienation is something that is going on. And sometimes actually it's just that parents need a little bit of help and a little bit of structure to the arrangements of the children following separation. And it's those kind of circumstances where something like mediation might provide that forum to put that structure in place to stop these things from happening when it's at a low level.
Fantastic. And do judges take the kind of markers, I suppose, that you're mentioning? Do they take them into consideration? Can they see through potential manipulation as well?
Yes, they do. It's certainly something that the courts are alive to. In fact, if you ever got to a point where a court application was made, quite often the court have a sort of court-appointed social worker, for want of a better word, called CAFCAS, and they've created an entire sort of framework that their court advisors look at in trying to establish alienating behaviours and really flag it from the offset. So it's certainly something that they are alive to, the courts, and are taking into consideration. But what they've made very clear is it's about looking at the individual behaviours and the impact that those behaviours are having on the children on a sort of case-by-case basis. It's not about sort of, you know, trying to find the term parental alienation. It's about the alienating behaviours and the specific impact and looking at that. And that's why it's so important to actually, you know, really think about what's happening and the behaviour that is happening so that you can, you know, really clearly identify it for the court if it's there.
That's, I have to say, it's great to hear the thought and effort and processes and systems in place to put the child at the center and of any kind of potentially damaging behavior. So I think it's really reassuring to hear that's what happens. Now, Jodie, have you any more top tips for parents in around parental alienation? What is your guidance?
Yeah, I mean, I think this sort of touches on what you were just saying, Lydia. It's really about trying to put the child first at every possible opportunity. So if you find yourself in a situation where somebody is saying to you that where you feel your child is being alienated from you, it's about, you know, persevering with that relationship with the child. And that's not necessarily saying, you know, go ahead and make a court application. It's persevering with that relationship. So, you know, making sure that you're sending those cards, you're sending those gifts, you're reaching out to the child, you're texting them to say, look, you know, I'm here if you want to talk, I love you, those sorts of things, so that they know that you're there. And if there is a pattern and a narrative being created by the other parent, doing really simple things like that is going to make the child, hopefully, potentially at some point, question, well, hang on a minute, you know, this isn't a case that, for example, dad's up to left and he's not interested, because dad keeps showing up, dad keeps you know, sending me these things that, you know, dad keeps checking in, even when I'm saying or not replying. And I would caveat it to say, you know, don't bombard them. You know, there is a balance, but, you know, making sure you're persevering with that relationship is so important.
That's so lovely to hear. And again, look, lovely, simple examples of what you can be doing as a parent before mediation and before going to the law courts, just to do your level best to make sure that the child is reassured that they're loved by both parents and that they are the most important thing in the breakup of the partnership. And I think everybody has the best intentions most of the time. And if parental alienation happens unconsciously, then this is a great way to just row it back and pull the child back into the centre. Now, I'd like to say huge thanks to Jodie Moore from Raiden Solicitors for her incredibly helpful, valuable advice in and around the idea of parental alienation. And I have to say, I think it was really, really helpful hearing her kindness on the issue, because ultimately, as she said, the child comes first. Right. So that's the end of this segment of the show. Thanks again to Jodie Moore for joining us from Raiden Solicitors. Please join us again after the break. Hello and welcome back to the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. So tonight I'm talking to David Pearce, who is coming to us from Let's Play at Bernard's Heath, in case you haven't heard about it. And he'll be telling us all about the great work that organisation is doing. Hi, David. How are you doing?
Oh, hi there, Lydia. Very well, thank you.
Thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me on.
So in case anybody out there hasn't heard of Let's Play at Bernard's Heath, tell us a bit about what you are doing, have done, will be doing.
Sure. Yeah, we were set up around 5 years ago. We were working closely with the council, and we were set up purely to raise funds for replacing the very old and tired play equipment on Bernard's Heath. Around that time, we received some money in through Section 106, which just meant there was a kickoff to our project. That was around 38,000. And since then, we've set up the charity in order to try and raise as much money as we can to refurbish that play area.
That's fantastic. So real grassroots organisation.
Absolutely, yeah. It was set up, say, just purely to raise that money for the playground by some local parents with children at the nearby Bernard's Heath schools.
Brilliant. So that's what I was going to ask you. So who is we? We is local residents.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are four trustees within the charity. I work with two ladies called Katie and a lady called Nikki. They've all either have or have had children at Bernard's Heath infant and junior schools. And that includes myself as well. My children are now a bit older because I started this so long ago.
But that, still, there'll be lots of other kids who'll benefit from your hard work.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the new generation that we're doing this for. Yeah, mine have moved on a little bit, but I'm sure they'll still like to see some of the bigger pieces of equipment that we could potentially build there, like a zip wire or something like that.
So that brings me on to my next question nicely. So what are the plans? What are you going to do when you get the funding?
So originally we were at sort of target was going to be 120,000 if we could possibly reach that amount. We're still trying to get around 100,000 if we can. The reason we reduced that down a bit was just owing to we applied for so many grants, but it's very hard to be able to sort of hit those exactly on, you know, with all the criteria that they're looking for and with the timings as well. But so we've got £75,000 currently already in the bank, and we would like to hit 100,000. That would allow us to completely refurbish the play equipment that's inside the fencing. If you've been to the Heath there, inside the fencing, we will completely change everything in there. And if we've got enough money, we'll also put some items just outside that area as well for the older ones as well.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds brilliant. And it's such a lovely spot at Bernard's Heath. I think everybody loves a stroll up there every now and then. I think I went to a medieval festival there a few years ago, and it's just it's a lovely spot to gather, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing just how many people do use it. There are a huge number of families living within a minute's walk, 2 minutes walk of the heath. And after school, particularly when the sun is out, all the children come straight over to use the equipment. It's just a shame that it's just not up to sort of modern standards. Some of the new parks that we've seen, both Clarence and Vera Lame, we've got some fantastic new pieces of equipment there. Obviously, it's a little way to go in order for them to travel over there. So, we want to do something for, you know, on our heath that's accessible to all the local families.
It's a very, very laudable effort. And has it been a lot of work? I mean, you said 5 years ago, I have to ask about the elephant in the room. Did COVID scupper all your plans?
Sadly so, yeah, along with a lot of other, great causes that are trying to raise awareness or money. We also were affected massively by COVID. We'd just set the charity up in 2019. And had drawn up some amazing looking designs of what the playground could potentially look like. We were doing residents questionnaires and we were showing everybody those designs. That was January 2020. And so at that moment, everything completely went on hold. All the companies and people that we might be turning to asking for donations, obviously in a similar boat and weren't in that position to give. So that's what we're doing now. We're back. It's been a long pause, but we recently won a grant of £25,000, and that's kicked things off again. So we're in the final stage now, and hope to be able to build something amazing there, either later this year or absolute latest would be spring next year.
It's getting very close.
It certainly is, yeah.
And is there consensus on what you're going to build there? Or do you find that it's hard to agree? Because, I mean, there are so many options out there. Like you say, I mean, I've seen the new Verulamium, the new Clarence Park. I mean, there are so many wonderful things. When I think of the years I spent digging the sandpit in Clarence Park, if only that had been there when my kids were young. But there are so many options to develop children's dexterity and, you know, gross motor skills. How do you decide?
Absolutely. There are hundreds of pieces of amazing equipment out there. We have spoken to quite a number of play equipment manufacturers already. They've showcased some of the items that they've got. It's things have moved on so quickly. So what's there now really is looking dated. We did a residents questionnaire that went out to literally hundreds. I think we had 1,500 that were put through letterboxes, and we emailed it out to as many as we could. We had many, many responses back on that. And we asked people to say what they'd like to see there. What was their top items? Things like zip wire, a trampoline, the various different swings, a basket swing that, you know, you can get more than one or two on at once and looks great fun. So those kinds of things are very high on our list of things that we'll be asking for. Obviously, it all comes down to budget with just how many items, but we'll hopefully work through the most asked for items and make sure they're included. And, the usual swings and roundabouts, hopefully will all be in there as well. But say number one was the zip wire, and I've seen the fantastic double zip wire at Clarence. It'd be great if we could afford something like that as well.
Brilliant. So now how are you going to nail the final 25,000, is it that what you need to get you where you need to be?
Yeah, ideally that would really see us with a good sized budget in order to get most of these pieces in. So the final fundraising campaign is via an engraved brick campaign. So we're inviting all residents, families, friends, grandparents who want to get involved as well. You can donate to the charity and you effectively buy a brick, which will then be installed at the site, at the playground entrance, with your family name or whatever you choose to put on it. And they'll all be laid out like a sort of welcome mat for when you get there. We're also inviting local companies as well, or groups, to also to have slightly larger bricks for them as well.
Oh, that's a lovely idea. And can people who donate choose the amount that they want to donate?
What we're doing is we're asking for a minimum donation of £100 for a family or a personal brick. And then we've got other options going up from there, which then include you can have extra letters, gold coloured letters. And say the corporate bricks likewise can be, they'll be a bit bigger, but black or gold lettering, and they go up to £500.
Fantastic. And has this initiative now been launched?
Yes, it has. We launched just over a week ago. Pleased to say it's going really well so far. We've had a really good response. We've yet to push this out to all the local schools. That's our next step. But getting ourselves out, getting the, you know, campaign out there in the public eye is going to be our next step on social media as well.
Fabulous. So if there's a parent listening in who wants to buy a brick, how do they do it? How do they get in touch?
They just can go onto our website. That is www.letsplayatbernardsheath.org, and all the information and instructions should be on there. And they can choose what to write on their brick. There are some limitations on the number of letters, but it's all explained on there. And then once we finish the campaign, probably around the end of July, all the bricks then will be delivered to the site in time for the refurbishment when we get that done.
Brilliant. So you reckon you might have it done this year?
We're going to push really hard to do that if we can. That'd be lovely if we can, you know, get that money in really quickly and then get on with the build. As you can imagine, it takes quite a bit of, there's a lot of processes involved with going to the playground equipment manufacturers, then coming back with designs, then being scored and selected, and then finally, the actual build phase as well. But if we can do something later this year, we will. But as I said earlier on, it will be spring at the absolute latest next year.
Brilliant. David, well done to you and your trustees for all the work you've done. Are you feeling excited now that there's a kind of an end in sight?
We all definitely are. There's been moments where you think, is this ever going to happen? It's been very tough, but we've sort of stuck with it all this time, and sort of say it's one final big push. We're very excited and hope to get this all done for the local community very soon.
Oh, there's nothing like, you know, when the school day ends, to be able to, my children went to Fleetville to kind of flood out onto the rec and just burn off a bit of energy running around on using the zip wire. There's really, really, I mean, it's such a fantastic way to end the day after you've been kind of cooped up in school. So I hope you manage it, and I hope you manage it soon.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Yeah, there's nothing better than, you know, thinking, imagining all the children come rushing out, and there's really some really fun bits of equipment there for them to come and let off their steam, and parents to hang out and chat as well. So yes, just fingers crossed we can get that money in soon, and we'll get it done. We'll get it built.
Great stuff. So just to remind our listeners one more time about the website. It's
letsplayatbernardsheath.org.
Lovely. Listen, David, all the best. I can't wait to see the photos. Please email them and we'll share them on our Facebook page.
Sure.
As well.
Yep, that'd be a pleasure.
Take care. Thanks a million.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Thanks, Lydia. Bye-bye.